On this episode of the Grow With Tim podcast, we're going to give you 80% of the value in 20% of the time. Coming up next. Welcome back. I'm J.D., your host for the Grow With Tim podcast.
And I'm Tim Joyner.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a little while, and I'm really excited about this particular episode because Tim, earlier in the summer, spent some time with Richard Koch, the 80-20 principle guy. Many of you listeners out there probably know or have heard of what that is, but we went straight to the source. And Tim has got a lot of storytelling that I'm going to pull out of him here. And I promised everybody in 20% of the time. I think actually we'll take plenty of time to talk it through. So why don't you first tell us, Tim, how you got connected to this billionaire, author, investor, and a little bit about his background and some of his story.
Yeah, so Richard Koch is probably best known as the author of the 80-20 principle, right? Also known as the Pareto principle. Mm-hmm. So this guy, Alfredo Pareto, invented this principle or discovered it 100 some years ago. But Richard is the guy who really popularized it. And if you haven't heard of that principle, in a nutshell, it's he noticed that 20% of the world controlled 80% of the wealth.
Right.
But he noticed also that 20% of the landowners controlled 80% of the land. And 20% of the pea pods in his garden produced 80% of the peas. And 20% of the clothes in his closet got worn 80% of the time. And 20% of products and services for most companies produce 80% of the revenue. And 20% of churchgoers donate 80% of the revenue. And all of this 80-20 thing was just showing up everywhere, right? And Richard is a guy who really applied that for the masses and said, this is how you use this principle to massively improve your life and grow your wealth. So that's what he's known for. But he's actually worth about $1.6 billion. He's been very successful at investing in businesses. He started a consulting firm. He used to work at Boston Consulting Group and Bain & Company. So a really, really smart guy, really successful, author of about a dozen books, and genuinely a really nice, down-to-earth guy.
Okay, so 20% of the inputs create 80% of the outputs of production or money, in our case, maybe if we're talking about business.
Yeah.
Okay, so we know a little bit about Richard at this point. I want to know how you got connected. Remind us about this entrepreneurial group that travels that you're in and how you guys got in front of this man.
So I've been part of a group called M3 for the last 3 or 4 years.
That's right.
And we meet sometimes in the metaverse, sometimes in Zoom, but at least once a month we meet and we really challenge each other to think bigger. We help each other solve problems and take advantage of opportunities and try to get better as entrepreneurs. At least 2 or 3 times a year, we travel somewhere and meet somebody really interesting.
So not in the metaverse. You saw Richard
in
person.
We saw him
sure
in person.
You saw him in
Portugal.
I'm sure
it was actually there. I got on an airplane.
What will they think of next, right?
So we've talked before about some of the things we've done. We've raced supercars on a closed track, shot machine guns out of helicopters and played laser tag in the sky and all kinds of cool stuff. Yeah. But we've also gone to visit some really successful people, including several billionaires, and this was one such trip. So we went, a small group of us went to Portugal. We spent 4 days over there, plus travel, and I guess actually more like 6 days, but 4 days with Richard, really picking his brain, going on walks with him, having dinner with him, visiting his house, just getting to know him and learning from him and trying to capture as much from this really successful guy as possible. So that was the trip.
All right. So generically, at this point in the last couple of years, you've been able to have several conversations with several different billionaires.
Right. I think several different... six maybe in counting so
okay.
far. Okay.
Okay.
Like
so now my question is, when you think about a billionaire, the average person or maybe us growing up, think about a billionaire. What have you noticed about his lifestyle or these other folks' lifestyle that I wouldn't have thought that, or it was different than I expected, anything like that? Or was it like, no, it was billionaire status means something?
What I've noticed is that they're all very different. So it's not like there's a stamp that turns out billionaires and, oh, this is how you have to become a billionaire.
Okay, right.
Like,
so
there's
hope for you.
There's hope for us.
Okay,
absolutely.
Good. Okay, good.
I don't know that I necessarily want to be a billionaire, but there's some perks for sure. But like some of them work really, really hard and they're workaholics. They work all the time and they believe that that's the only way to succeed. And then others like Richard Koch, as we'll talk about later today, works 5 hours a week.
Right.
Last year,
In 2023, I joined the M3 group. We went to Texas. We met Drayton McLean.
Right.
McLean Trucking, groceries, and all that type of distribution. And he was a working man.
He was.
He was a working. He was not an 80-20 guy in terms of time.
7 o'clock in the morning, right. He's at the office. He works until 6 on Saturdays. He comes in at 8, goes home at 1, I think, something right. He's 70-some years old, and he's still yeah. working 60-hour weeks, right?
So now I was looking up Richard, and Richard is 73.
Yes.
Okay. Be 74 later this year, and he obviously is talking about not working
right.
that often, but does he really live like that? What did you notice?
Yeah, so that was my perception. Like, he wrote a book called The 80-20 Principle,
right. And
he
which says is to work less. I love that book. So yeah, right. I've book. Listened to it several times.
But you know that sometimes to sell books, there's a difference between the marketing veneer and the real rubber meets the road life that's behind it, right? Everybody puts on a shiny exterior.
Right, right.
So I thought, all right, fine, you want to sell books, and you say you work 5 hours a week, but do you really? So I got his assistant.
Okay. Right?
He has lots of assistants, as
sure.
you might expect.
Okay.
He's got homes scattered all over the world, one in Cape Town, one in the Azores, one in Gibraltar, one in Portugal, one in England, like all over. And each one has a full-time assistant, which I thought was interesting. But the assistant that manages all the assistants is Ricardo. And
okay.
I spent a lot of time
got
with
it.
Ricardo. And I said, Ricardo, I got him away from Richard. I said, Ricardo, really, how many hours a week does this man work? I said, about 5. I said, so what? What does he do with
right?
the rest
what
of his
time?
What
is happening for the rest of the day?
And he said, oh,
the
he,
week.
He goes on walks, he feeds his fish, he reads books, he goes out to dinner, he has leisure activities.
So that's a long walk.
Yeah,
first
right.
off, I'm trying
he does.
To
he spends
out.
About 2 hours a day walking.
Okay,
he's
so
got
he really
a lot
does.
Of land, and he goes like
and
hiking,
he
and he walks.
And, okay, very
he takes
good.
His dog along.
All right, so Ricardo's backing up what practice.
Yeah,
he's
that's
saying,
right.
practicing what he's preaching.
He's
here.
Saying it really is true.
Okay.
So then I said, okay, all right, fine. He's a billionaire. He can afford to do that, right?
Okay,
well, no,
right.
no. What I learned was he started working 5 hours a week long before he was a billionaire. So he became a billionaire while working 5 hours a week. So that's interesting. But then I said, okay, fine. He's got some special sauce. There's something weird about him.
Right.
But that doesn't apply to normal people, right? So Richard owns 7 companies.
Okay.
So I said, Ricardo, these 7 CEOs that run these companies, how many hours did they work? And he said something really interesting. He said, well, if they're the founders, we bought their company, but they started it.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably working too much, but we teach them how to delegate and how to work a lot less. And if they can't learn to delegate, we replace them.
Really? Okay.
It's interesting. What about Ricardo? What if you install the CEO? How many hours are they working? He said, maybe 5 or 10 hours a week. I said, okay. So the CEOs that are running these multi-billion dollar companies, they're working 5 or 10 hours a week. Richard's working 5 or 10 hours a week, but you're the guy that really makes all this happen.
Like, right, right.
You buy and sell houses for Richard. You hire and fire staff for Richard. You run the empire. How many hours are you working, Ricardo? He says, well, normally I come in at 9 and I go home at 2.
Okay, who is working? That's what I want to know. Is anyone working?
So the point of this is, yeah. Richard says, look, if you figure out what 20% of your inputs are actually yielding 80% of the results, you don't have to work all the time, because we all know that some of our hours create enormous value and some of our hours are basically wasted time. So let's like group them and be honest about, look, if you want to waste your time by, I don't know, surfing social media or binge watching Netflix or whatever, then let's just not call that work and not feel guilty about it. Like, let's figure out how to actually work when you're working and work on the right things and do the things that are going to create enormous value, and then don't work the rest of the time. By the way, I don't recommend either of those things. I don't think so. Binge watching Netflix or surfing social media is actually a great alternative.
I was starting to daydream. I was like, okay, I can do that.
But the point is that you don't have to work 50 or 60 hours a week or even 40 hours a week if you figure out the work that really matters. And evidently it's not just Richard, but his whole empire has figured out how to do that.
Now, that's very interesting. And so what you're also saying, what I'm finding interesting, is it's not necessarily about what type of work you do either. Maybe these companies are in different areas.
Absolutely.
Maybe people
They're
have different type
areas.
Of responsibilities, and
right.
it's still 80-20 still applies.
Right. I think the only real – I mean, if you work on an assembly line, right, maybe you have to work a full week in order to make a living, right, because you're making widgets.
Sure.
But for many of us, and I would say most of us, that think if you're in a white-collar environment, you're producing value with your brain. Not all hours are created equal.
Right.
And if you figure out the hours – so that was the most thought-provoking question that Richard asked me. He said, Tim, out of the last 12 months – big question – the last 12 months, what single hour has created the greatest economic value?
Wow, that's deep.
What single hour out of the last year, which hour was the most valuable? And then the implication, of course, is, well, figure out what you were doing during that hour and do a lot more of that. And all the stuff that you were doing the other time that didn't produce the greatest results, that was largely wasting time, figure out how to do less of that. And you'll end up with a lot more time, better quality of life, more money, more success. Like, just figure out the stuff that actually matters and do that, and figure out how to eliminate or automate or delegate everything else.
Now, I'm starting to realize that if you're feeding fish, and that's in your five other things that you're doing today, taking walks, going to dinner, that type of thing, that is probably a lot of mental load and stress that is also gone. They probably, these guys that you met and some of their people, probably not living with a lot of guilt either.
I think
maybe you and I think we have a badge of honor coming alongside of us by working hard and by working more and by working longer. What do you think about that?
That was part of the point, was like, it's not just a luxury to work less. Richard would say it's a necessity. Ricardo said, look, we fire guys if they don't learn how to work less. So it's not just that I want
to. So you're saying I might be able to be acquired or hired by these guys, and then I don't have to work.
And then you don't have to work.
I love this. Okay,
yeah, right.
Very good.
So the idea is,
figure out how to go home. Well, I'm great. I'm in.
Richard says you've got to have the time and space to think and to make good decisions. And if you're working all the time, you're constantly doing, you just don't have the mental bandwidth to actually think and decide and make good discoveries and figure out a formula that works. You've got to have time to think, and lots of it. So it's not just a luxury to work less. It's actually a necessity, according to Richard.
That reminds me of maybe it's a Carnegie or a Rockefeller, Henry Ford type quote that says, if men are working all day, when do they have time to make money?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, well, right? I must be doing something wrong.
Right?
I mean, that's what I thought I had to do. Very interesting. Okay.
Right.
Now, what type of conversations were you able to have with Richard? We all know 80-20 principle because we can find that book. We can watch videos on that. I'm a big fan in that book particularly, and I listen to it every year.
Yeah.
But what was he working on? What was he focused on? What did he tell you guys?
So we talked a lot about his books. He's written about a dozen. And I asked him at one point, Richard, what's your motivation for writing a book? You obviously don't need the money. And comparatively, even though, you know, he sold 1 million copies of the 80-20 principle, but even if you figure he's making 10 bucks a copy, that's not really a lot of money compared to the billions that he has. So why write books? And he said, oh, that's easy. He says, that's how I learn. He says, anytime I decide I want to learn about something, the most efficient way is to write a book about it. So I just study it, I research it, I think about it, and then I write a book. And the book is really more for me than it is for the people that read it.
Okay, very good. Now, your buddy Dan Sullivan is in a similar vein to that idea. I realize something is there, or we unearth it or uncover it, and then we get it codified into a book and give it to all of our students and say, hey, apply this in your life.
Right.
So, okay. Now, the best way to learn something is to study it first, right? And then give it
to
the Sunday school class, or maybe put in a book for your students. Okay.
So we talked about the books and his motivation for it, but one book that really, in fact, his favorite book, it's not his bestseller, but it's The Star Principle. And we talked a lot about The Star Principle. So I'll give you a quick overview of it. This is a little bit maybe more esoteric than the 80-20 principle, but Richard would say this one principle is why he's a billionaire. He would say this is all you've got to know to become a billionaire is the Star Principle.
Okay, this is it.
This is it.
This is it, everyone.
So if you can picture, and maybe we'll put up on the screen for those of you that are watching this podcast, there's a chart, and it's called the Boston Box. If you want to Google it, the Boston Box, it was developed by Boston Consulting Group, which, by the way, is where Richard got his start. He was a consultant at Boston Consulting Group. Then he left followed Bill Bain to Bain & Company. Then later, he with two partners from Bain, he started LEK, grew that firm from 3 to 350 consultants, and really did phenomenally well at all of those. But the Boston Box was this simple framework that they developed a long time ago, and they would go into these big companies, publicly traded companies, companies like, you know, 3M or DuPont or whatever, and they would charge millions of dollars to basically teach them this one concept called the Boston Box.
Okay.
So here it is.
All right.
A box with four quadrants, right? So the vertical axis, up and down, we have the growth of the market. So nothing to do with your company, but the industry that you're in, and specifically the niche, the narrow slice of industry that you're in, how fast is that market growing?
Okay.
If it's growing faster than 20%, you're going to be in the upper echelon. If it's growing less than 20%, it's going to be in the bottom, right? So the faster the growth, the that's the vertical axis. The other is your relative market share. And it's actually, for whatever reason, in reverse order. So from the first quadrant, then, if you're thinking the way we read in Western,
left to right,
the first one up there is going to be a star. So you are both the market leader, meaning you're bigger than your biggest competition in that space.
Okay.
You're the market leader and that industry is growing fast. That's a star business. And he would say, that's the kind of business you want to start. That's the business you want to buy. That's the business you want to invest in. That's the kind of business you want to work for if you're, you know, working a traditional job. Only associate yourself with star businesses, and that's how you're going to get wealthy. And so there was a lot of theory about why that works. Why is it important that the market niche is growing, and why is it important that you have the greatest relative market share? And the book gets into that better than I could do. But in short, you're going to have, if you're the market leader, your cost to deliver whatever product or service is automatically going to be less than the next nearest competitor, but the market sets the rate. So you're going to be able to charge a premium price. You're going to be able to have lower cost of goods. Basically, you're going to be wildly more profitable. And if your industry is growing, rising tide lifts all boats, you're going to be a star business. You're going to make a lot of money. So the other, just to round it out, the other quadrants, if you move over one, you're still in a fast growing industry, but you're not the market leader, then you become a question mark. The question is, are you going to be able to become the market leader and become a star?
Got it.
Or are you going to slip down into one of the other quadrants, which I'll say next. So now we move down. We're no longer, we're the market leader, but we're not in a fast growing industry. That's called the cash cow. You can build that business and make a lot of money. You're never going to be a star. You're not going to dramatically increase the market value of the company. You're not going to be able to sell it for a huge multiple, but you can just milk it. It's a cash cow. It's going to throw off a lot of cash if you're the market leader, because remember, your costs are lower. You can charge a premium price that the market sets. You're going to make a lot of money. And then finally, you have the dogs. Okay. If you're neither the market leader, nor are you in a high growth industry, you're a dog. And so when they would go in as Boston Consulting Group and consult using this Boston box, they would basically look at each individual business line. So, you know, you've got the chemicals division and you've got the post-it notes division and you've got all these different divisions. And we would say, all right, are you the market leader and are you in a high growth industry? And depending on your answers to those questions, we would say either, well, maybe we need to buy a company so that we can become the market leader, or we need to invest massively in sales and marketing and branding to become the market leader or whatever. Or maybe we say, you know what, we're never going to become the market leader. We should sell and get out of this business. If you're in the cash cow position, figure out how to optimize your resources and milk it for all you're worth, but also start investing in something that can become a star. If you're in a dog business, get out right away, sell it for whatever you can. Right? So anyway, that's what they would do. And literally they made hundreds of millions of dollars just basically on this one formula called the Boston box. Made a lot of money with it.
Right, right.
That's what Richard means when he says, look, if you're busy all the time, you're never going to have time to invent things like the Boston box, or Richard's favorite, the Bananagram, which he invented personally.
Okay.
He says, you've got to have time to read and think to invent those formulas. And when you figure out the formula, you can work exactly the number of hours that you want and make as much money as you want because the formula is doing the work. But you've got to figure out the formula and you need time to do that.
That's very interesting. So the Star Principle.
Star Principle is a book. He's got a book on it. It's a great book. Read it. You can watch videos online. You can read blog posts about it. But basically, you want to invest in, build, buy, work for star businesses and ignore everything else. And that's why he would say, he says, I only invest in star businesses. And by the way, over the last 37 years, his compound annual growth rate is 22%. So that's like beating the market by, you know, three times, give or take.
Right, right. Each year.
Each year, 22%.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you think about the compounding effect of 22% a year for 37 years. No wonder the man's a billionaire, right?
Right. Interesting. So you and I sat down and we had an interesting conversation about 3 weeks ago, right before you left. And we talked about, in a lunch meeting, your bane. The bane in your capital was that you needed to buy back time.
Right.
So now I want to grill Tim a little bit here. Tell us how you interpreted some of these messages based on what you're doing right now, some of your business operations and things like that. I know you took notes on it and I know you're thinking about it. So how did this affect you to hear this from the top guy?
So I've learned over time that I'm a really experiential learner. I can read a book. I can hear somebody talk about something, but really seeing it and experiencing it for me is maybe the only way to get it through my thick skull. And so seeing these guys and meeting several of them and actually realizing they actually are practicing what they're preaching, for one, it was just kind of inspiring and validating, like, huh, maybe that's more possible than I thought. For another, it was like, maybe before I thought of it more as a luxury, and now I'm starting to think of it as a necessity. I've really got to figure out how to buy back my time. So I've either eliminate some things, I automate some things, maybe I systematize, make it more efficient, or delegate some things. But I've really got to clean up the hours that I'm working. And the one phrase that I think was most helpful that I heard Richard say multiple times was, never do for yourself what a lower cost resource is capable of doing.
Interesting.
Never do for yourself what a lower cost resource is capable of doing. I know that's not rocket science. Like, I believed that. I would have told you something similar before I went there. Of course, you shouldn't. If your effective bill rate is $500 an hour or $5,000 an hour or $50,000 an hour, you shouldn't be doing $25 or $50 or $100 an hour work, right? I know that. But he really applied it to the nth degree. Like, never do for yourself what a lower cost resource is capable of doing unless you derive personal enjoyment from it, right? Obviously, if you love washing your car on a Saturday, then by all means, go wash
Feeding
your car.
Feeding fish. That's the one that I'm wondering. Maybe that's the key to my billion. Feed the fish.
That's a great example, actually, yeah. Because clearly he could hire someone to feed his fish. But I saw him feed his fish. He's got this amazing like fish pond with this little gazebo built right out in the middle of it. And he goes out there and he tosses the fish. And there's these massive like koi and other fish and stuff. And ask him about names and like, oh, that one's P&L. That one's balance sheet.
Oh,
he was just joking.
Okay,
it wasn't really that. Anyway, the point is he derives personal pleasure from that. So he doesn't hire somebody to feed his fish. But most things in his life he's not doing. Right. Most of the things that you and I are doing for ourselves, he's not doing. Right. And so that framework, never do for yourself what a lower cost resource is capable of doing. He said, we taught that to entry level consultants at LEK and Bain and Company and Boston Consulting Group. Like, you might be your first year out of grad school and you've just started with us, but we don't want you getting your own lunch. We don't want you doing anything that a lower cost resource is capable of doing, because we want you to either be working or thinking or relaxing. Now, it's not like you're feeding your fish and you're working your brain like, huh, how am I going to do
right,
this?
That's or, where I no, feel no, no, that no, I would that's spend the it. First couple of days of fish feeding is like, I should be doing something else. Yeah. There's mail to be opened.
Yeah, no, it's literally leisure. And sometimes in the midst of leisure, you're going to get a great idea. But sometimes just the combined effect of all of that mental freedom is going to yield really great formulas, as Richard would call it. So for me, never do for yourself what a lower cost resource is capable of doing. I need to do some more work thinking about what does that look like in real life. I've already taken some action on that, but there are still too many things I do that, look, I don't need to be doing them. I'm not, maybe not even particularly good at doing them, and I certainly don't derive pleasure from them. Why on earth am I still doing them?
Now, a few weeks ago, you and I also had a conversation about the who's in your life, the who's and not all the how's, right?
Right.
You've got who's for the how's, and we've had another podcast on that idea.
Right.
My question for you is, a guy who came up with, as far as I remember, over 20, 25 different who's in your life. Maybe
yeah.
It was even more than
that.
It was
more than that, yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
About 70.
Oh, about 70.
Yeah.
Okay. But you're still at a place where you're trying to, as one of my mentors and thought leaders in the financial space has named it, R. Nelson Nash, rethink your thinking. You got to go back
right.
to square one
yep.
and start over maybe.
Yep.
And that sounds like maybe where you are. Do you think the other M3 entrepreneurs kind of had that thought process going on as well?
It was interesting. Richard actually surveyed us in like a confidential little questionnaire about how many hours we were working. The average, I don't know, I wrote it down and I don't know if I can find it quickly. It was pretty interesting. Yeah, here it is. So this small group of entrepreneurs, all of whom are very successful, they're
right,
making a lot
right,
of money, right?
I was wondering. Yeah.
Okay. The high was 60 hours on a weekly basis. The low was 5 hours. The median was 32.5, and the average was 33.75.
Okay.
So the average entrepreneur in M3 is working in the low 30s.
Which is probably not all that different maybe from an average standard line worker. At a regular job, when I look at that, 60 hours for some people, maybe in leadership, white collar, Median 32.5, average.
Yeah.
That seems typical. Now, 32, 5 obviously is super low, so right. That's an outlier. But
I would say for entrepreneurs, working 30 hours is crazy low.
That's true.
That's crazy low, right? Your typical business owner is working 60-hour weeks, right? So, but then he also asked, how many hours do you want to work? And our average there, the median was 20. The average was 21.6. So he noted that was about a 1/3 reduction. So then he asked us a pretty pointed question. He's like, why are you guys working so hard? Like, why are you working so much? No, really. Like, why? Okay. And he made us answer.
Right.
Like, why are you, if you want to be working less.
Now, did you want to be working less?
I did. Yeah, okay. I did. Absolutely.
What was your why? Why are you working so much, Tim?
Yeah, well, so he asked. And the questions answers that came up were, in some cases, it's a habit. Like, we've always worked hard. We've always worked 60-hour weeks or 70 or 80-hour weeks or whatever. Some of it's social pressure. Some of it's guilt. Like, if you're not working, you feel like, man, I kind of feel guilt. Like, I should be doing something, right? But I think a lot of it is just an invisible script, as Ramit Sethi says, like, well, I'm an entrepreneur. I got to work hard. That's how you succeed, right? And I don't want to be lazy. And so, anyway, it was a thought-provoking session for sure, like, or that conversation, like, why am I working as many hours as I am? I need to fix that.
Now, well, let's move on to some of those takeaways and the applications for our audience. A lot of folks who are listening to us, we've learned over the course of the last 2 years or so, having this podcast and different type of social conversations, that they're growth-minded entrepreneurs. They are in leadership. They've got people who they might be able to delegate and consult with. What do they take from this? You're the one who met the billionaire. You've got the goods. So how can we move forward? Because I've grilled you on a couple of personal applications now. What does the average person do next?
Yeah, I mean, certainly those two books that we've mentioned, he's got other great books too, but I think The Star Principle and The 80-20 Principle, if you haven't read those two books, go buy them, right? They're easy to find and they're not very expensive and they're worth a lot. So that's one. I would say another great activity would be, we've talked about this before, do an activity inventory on yourself. Like, inventory, what is it that you're doing with your time? So write down a list of everything that you do. And I mean, be really granular. Like, I open the mail, if you still open the mail. I send out invoices or I do the accounting, but also I do high-level consulting and I brainstorm and I lead my team lead meetings and whatever it is that you do. Just make a big list of that and then say, which of these are really creating enormous value and everything else should be either eliminated or automated or delegated, right? So that would be one immediate takeaway, is just take stock of what you're doing and stop doing most of it.
Now, do you think that the average entrepreneur out there actually has paid attention to that 1 hour, that one meeting, that 1 week that made all the difference? How do we get down to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I've spent now multiple hours thinking about. Like, that was a really thought-provoking question. And I would encourage you, if you're listening to this, maybe you're driving or you're whatever you're doing, like, maybe you can't stop right this second and do it, but get out your calendar and block off a couple hours to think about that question. Like, what have you done over the last 12 months that's been really enormously valuable? And figure out how to do more of that. So I think that would be an excellent takeaway. Most of us have never really thought about out of the last.
And it's not a hard question to. It's a hard question to come up with, but it's not a hard one to hear. Like, which hour or which job or which customer makes all the difference?
Yeah.
And why don't we focus on that or find more people to duplicate like that? Now, I got to mess with you again. You just said you spent multiple hours trying to get down and think through that. Which of those hours that you were thinking about was the most pointed hour to help you get to that hour? You know, it's really crazy because it does become the 20% of the 20% of the 20% sometimes. Yeah. Obviously, with a guy who's got a lot of things happening for him and over $1 billion, but feeds his fish and takes walks and goes to dinner with friends, obviously has really narrowed it down over and over and over again.
And you mentioned something that's noteworthy. It's not just the 80-20 rule. It's like one of those infinity mirrors. Like, it does repeat. So if you go back to the wealth thing, right? 20% of the world's population controls 80% of the wealth. But now if you look at that top 20, 20% of the 20% controls 80% of that 20%, right? And it keeps going that way. And so if the company is big enough, like, you look at the customers, 20% of your customers. And by the way, it's not always mathematically exactly 20-80, right? Sometimes it's 75-25, and sometimes it's 90-10. Sometimes it's 95-5.
Pareto said a lot of 90-10 things before, averaged out more like 80-20.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's not always exactly 80-20, but you'll find no matter what, a minority of inputs create a majority of outputs. That's the takeaway. And so you find in your customers, like 20% of your customers are yielding 80%, but then, oh, look inside that 20%. Now, if you only have 10 customers, maybe it doesn't work this way. But if you have hundreds of customers, probably within that 20%, you have 20% of the 20 that's actually really that. If you take some time to look for this pattern in your life, you'll see it showing up all over the place. And then most people stop at like the intellectual curiosity level. Like, yeah. Oh, well, that's interesting.
Right.
But where you really start to win is if you say, okay, what am I going to do differently because of this knowledge? Okay, I'm going to start focusing on the 20% that really matter and eliminate everything else, which sometimes takes guts. Like, it's a little gutsy to, I don't know, depending on whether you're a pack rat or not, like if you want to go into your closet and actually throw away or donate 80% of your clothes, that's a little gutsy. It's really gutsy to fire 80% of your customers, right? But maybe that's what you actually need to do to focus on. I mean, if it's really true that 20% of your customers yield 80% of your profit, maybe I should get rid of the 80 so I've got more time to find more like the 20.
Right. How do we apply this to our organizations and the people within our organizations?
Yeah, that one's a tough one too, because you may find that some of your employees are really A+, producing enormous value, and some of them may not be. And you know, I've said before, firing somebody is the hardest thing that I've ever done. Maybe not the hardest, but one of the hardest things I've ever done, and certainly one of my least favorite things to do. And so I'm not saying be capricious or be ruthless or unkind about it, but you may have some people in your organization that are you've outgrown, right? That may be. So it does pay to take stock and say, are these people still growing with me, and are they still the right person for the bus? And maybe not.
Okay. Now, one more type of person in the organization I have a question about, and that's the people we're going to keep around. How do we get this culture in with them? Is there a bottom percent of their work they should get rid of?
Yeah.
You know, like you were saying that Ricardo was like, hey, we teach people in the organization how to delegate, eliminate.
Yeah. So Richard said he teaches everybody to drop the bottom half of their job description every year. Pretty interesting. So
I like this. I'm trying to work alongside a guy who says get rid of your job. This
right?
sounds great.
Right?
I'd like him to acquire me.
Right, exactly. All right. So if you're listening, Richard, right, here's your next acquisition target. So drop the bottom half of your job description. And the way that you're going to do that, same way that anybody does it, you're either going to eliminate it, you're going to automate it, or you're going to delegate it. So in many cases, you're going to delegate it, because if your company is growing, you're adding people. You're always hiring new people, and you're going to delegate the bottom half to that new person. But guess what? Next year, that person's going to delegate maybe some of those same things to somebody else that's new or that's junior or whatever. And that, by the way, is not, it's not that you're too good to do those things. I mean, you're legitimately giving opportunity to somebody else to grow and take on new responsibility, even as you continue to narrow your focus to what you're really good at and what you love to do, where you create enormous value. Look, if I create enormous value in my little slice of what I'm good at and what I love to do, and you create enormous value doing what you love to do and what you're good at, it's like 2 + 2 is going to equal 10, right? And you want a whole company of people that's 2 + 2 + 2 equals 25. And the way you do that is everybody does what they're really good at and what they love to do, and they delegate everything else.
All right. All you growth-minded entrepreneurs out there, that is the Grow With Tim podcast today. And although it wasn't 80% shorter than usual, I think this 20% of your day or work day or your thought process over the course of this day on this episode will really change your life. So for more information about what's going on with Tim, check out growwithtim.com, and we'll catch you on the next episode of this great podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's Grow With Tim podcast. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to show us some love by following us here and on our other social media platforms. You'll find all the links at growwithtim.com.